This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'll make a start. My name's David Arnold. I'm the Head of Learning Services and Community Outreach here at the Museum, and it's wonderful to see the Visions Theatre pretty well full. And I wonder whether that has anything to do with our speaker this lunchtime. So I thought I might start off with a quick question for you. Put your hand up if you know Matthew Higgins, or you like Matthew Higgins, or you really wanted to be here because it was Matthew Higgins. And how many of those people are on his email address? I think that's a really good indication, isn't it, of something about Matt that's really endearing and important, and that is that he really is a contributor. He's a contributor in so many ways to our life, not just around Canberra and the surrounds, but around Australia in terms of environmental interest and historical interest. I was thinking of words to describe Matt, and I think one of the words I've come up with is the word prolific. I think he's just a prolific writer, filmmaker, enthusiast, communicator, all sorts of things that he does in a really prolific way, and that's one of the reasons we're so fond and endeared to him. And of course, he was a fantastic staff member here at the museum for many years. We were sad to see him go a couple of years ago. And he's also worked, and many of you will know this, at the War Memorial, the Australian Heritage Commission. He works for the National Library still on oral histories. He's still doing all this work. And he unashamedly asked me to mention that his nominated book for the ACT Book of the Year in 2010. How many of you have a copy of this already? Fantastic. There's plenty of books in the shop for those of you who didn't put your hand up. On a serious note, it's a fantastic book. But also in this book, there is direct information and material on the theme of Matt's talk today, looking at these three remarkable men and the work they did surveying Canberra and its surrounds almost 100 years ago now. So there's direct material in this book that's great to read about as a follow-up to the lecture that Matt's about to deliver to us. So thanks very much, Matt. It's wonderful to have you back. And we really look forward to you. You're a consummate storyteller, and we look forward to you telling us more about these three men and the work that they did. Thanks very much. Welcome, Matt Higgins.
Well, thank you very much, Dave. And I took Dave and his partner Seema on a bushwalk just the other week. It was lucky to get him on side, and even lucky that I didn't get them lost. But it was a lovely day at the Yankee Hat Rock Art Site in our wonderful Namaji National Park. And look, it is fantastic to see so many people here today, because I'm actually giving this talk three times during our centenary year, and I thought, gee, you know, maybe the border's just not people's cup of tea. And if I split the audience three ways, Visions is a big venue. If you only have 12 people, it's very embarrassing. But not only did we have all of you book, we also had a waiting list. Perhaps the vacant chairs are due to the parking problem at the moment. It's all those civic office workers who take up the car park despite the big red sign. However, you coming here is really nice, and this is a great time to be telling an early Canberra story, a key early Canberra story, which is also a national story. It's wonderful to have the opportunity of the centenary year and also the excellent, glorious days down below in the temporary exhibition gallery. If you haven't had a look at it yet, make sure you do while it's on. It's a wonderful show, and as a former senior curator here, I'm well aware of all the hard work that staff at all levels and across all sections of this place make for shows like that. So my interest in the border really started in the 1990s when I became aware that there were surviving original survey marks from the original survey out along the ranges, and I thought, gee, these must be sites of incredible heritage significance to early Canberra, you know, the very birth of the territory. But hardly anyone outside the survey community seemed to know that they were there. And so through the good fortune of being awarded some federal and then ACT government heritage funding, I was able to undertake a twofold project. Firstly, to undertake an archival research project looking at why the border is where it is, who the surveyors were, how they surveyed the border, what their experiences were. And then the second half of the project was to go out and walk a nominated section of the border to try to find as many of the original survey marks as possible so that they might be conserved and their heritage value estimated, and so that the public might know this early Canberra story. And so it's been very gratifying since then to see the story of the border seeping out through government agencies and the community. Not long after the project was finished, many of the survey marks were placed on the ACT government's Interim Heritage Places Register. There have been interpretive signs put up along the border in various parts. There have been community bushwalks. In 2010, there was a community photographic competition related to the border. And that year, also up on the top of Mount Koree, there was an official event marking the centenary of the beginning of the border survey, which was attended by the ACT Chief Minister John Stanhope and the New South Wales Governor Dame Marie Bashir. And a whole range of people and agencies were involved in all of those things, and it's just great to have seen that story develop. And the fact that you are here today shows that the border story is not a dead story, it is a living story, and it's with us, and hopefully people will continue showing interest in it. They're all the good things. I mean, on the negative side of the ledger, there was the 2003 bushfire. And amongst the destruction caused by that fire, numbers of the more flammable survey marks, the timber posts, many of the hand engraved reference trees, they were destroyed, sadly. But there are other examples still on the ranges, and towards the end of the show, I'll show you some of those on the screen. So to give you a chance to participate and to make sure that you're all listening, I'm just going to ask you a bit of a quick quiz about the ACT border. Three quick questions. Firstly, can someone tell me how long the ACT border is? Say to the nearest 20 kilometres. Someone like to make a bid or a guess? We've got a few surveyors here. There's a few bids in the audience. I reckon they're surveyors. Quick guess. Come on, someone. 300. 900. Have I got an advance on 900? 1,000. Well, my good friend Ron Jarman, I think it is up in the top corner, is very close, 300. Yeah, 306. And that's not a very meaningful figure. So if you were to somehow wrestle with this very convoluted shape of the territory border and bend it into a straight line, it would take you from Canberra to Sydney, or just beyond the CBD, probably to the Corso at Manly. I looked it up on Google Maps, actually. So 306 kilometres, that's your distance. So that gives you an idea of the length surveyed during those 5 years, 1910 to 1915. Second question, what is the highest point on the ACT border? Mount Bimbri, okay. And what's the height of Bimbri? 1908, pretty close. Yeah. Oh, well, I go with 1911. It's shown on as 1913 on some maps as well. Maybe we should go with 1913, seeing as that's the centenary year. But anyway, it's only just over 300 metres lower than Kosciuszko. So it's a big peak in Australian terms. The lowest point on the border. What's the lowest point on the ACT border? Murrumbidgee? OK, now the border crosses the Murrumbidgee twice. Which one of those is going to be the lower? OK, downstream. Yes, we're firing now. So where the Murrumbidgee exits the territory, up a bit north of Yuriara Crossing, and the elevation there is about 430 metres. So between the highest point and the lowest point, you've got about 1,500 metres of elevation. 1,500 metres of surveying heaven or surveying hell, depending on the experience, and perhaps our three surveyors and their teams experienced both. So, let's start the story. Federation, a new entity, comes into being. The Commonwealth of Australia, the colonies become states, and Section 125 of the Constitution says we will have a national capital, and it will be somewhere in New South Wales, beyond a minimum distance from Sydney, and it will be in a federal territory. So the federal politicians set about finding a site, and they go through this assessment process. In 1904, they decide on Dalgetty, and the legislation is passed. But feisty New South Wales Premier Joseph Carruthers won't hand over the land because he believes the feds want more than what the Constitution says. So they go back to the drawing board, and they look through more sites. 4 years later, they decide on Yass, Canberra. And that looks good, looks like it's going to work, but it's a pretty nebulous sort of area. So you need someone experienced to go into that area and decide where is the city going to be within Yass, Canberra, and where is the territorial border going to run. So the person given that job is a very experienced senior New South Wales surveyor by the name of Charles Robert Scrivener, and he's in the front row, the bearded chap, second from the right. Very serious-looking man, but he had a lot of responsibilities, didn't he? And he very expeditiously set about finding the site for the city. Well, we all know where that is and what a wonderful choice it was. And then he set about thinking where should the border run. And in doing that, he was guided by one really overriding principle, water. The federal authorities wanted the territory to contain the water catchment for the new city. They did not want to have endless battles with New South Wales about pollution upstream. There'd been enough of that intercolonial rivalry during the 19th century. So it was water which was at the forefront of Scrivener's thinking in deciding where the territory should run. And so what he came up with initially was a horseshoe-shaped territory. So just ignore the sort of central part of this map. Just look at the part within the bold lettering. It's a horseshoe, OK? The bold line. And the western or left-hand part of that horseshoe is the Cotter River, obviously a great source of water, but Scrivener also wanted the Molonglo-Queanbeyan system because he wasn't 100% confident that the Cotter had enough water. And there was also thought of hydropower for the city. And also, even though the name Walter Griffin hadn't been heard on the limestone plains at this stage, it was known there would be ornamental water features in the new capital, so you wanted to control the river that they would be on, and that's the Molonglo. Scrivener, yes, he was a member of an advisory board making this decision. His fellows on the board, Percy Owen, the Director of Works in the Territory, David Miller from the Department of Home Affairs, who would be the administrator of the Territory, and the New South Wales Government architect, Walter Liberty Vernon. They agreed with Scrivener. It went off to Alfred Deakin, the Prime Minister. He said, yes, that looks good. So a letter went to New South Wales Premier Charles Wade. Okay, so he succeeded Carruthers. Now, Wade's a bit more conciliatory. He wants it to work. He says, yes, you can have the Cotter. That's just rubbishy mountain country. Well, how values have changed. But hardly anyone lived there, you see. But he didn't want to lose the upper Queanbeyan because quite a few people lived up there, grazing properties. He didn't want to lose the town of Queanbeyan. So he said, look, I'll give you the Cotter and the lower Molonglo below the railway line, but I won't give you the upper Queanbeyan. You can have water rights in that, and that certainly came in handy when we came to build Googong Dam in the 1970s. But to make up for that area, because I know you're after this sort of 900 square miles or so, I'll give you the centre part on our map, which is the watersheds of the combined Paddy's, Nace and Gudjonby rivers. So that came back to the federal government. They looked at it, and, of course, compromise is everything in politics. This was a good compromise, and so that's how the territory came into being. And when I have to describe what the territory looks like to people, it's such a strange shape, and I say, well, it's sort of like a mutant ear, perhaps with a cigarette stuck behind it pointing out towards Bungendore. But it's water that explains that shape because the bulk of our border follows watersheds. However, how this happened is just amazing, but despite all this emphasis on water, part of the vital Cotter catchment was cut off. And so we need to answer this Cotter catchment conundrum. How did that happen? Well, where you will see that straight line section up here, okay, that's about 30 kilometres from Mount Coree to One Tree Hill behind Hall. And it's that part of the border which cuts off a Cotter River tributary, Coree Creek. Now, over the years, stories arisen to try to explain how this happened. Now, all the rest of the border had been surveyed, but the government was running out of money. So the government said to the surveyors, look, just run a straight line, she'll be right. Now, it sounds great, but it's false, because rather than being the last part of the border surveyed, that straight line was the very first. And what I think happened was there was no way that Scrivener had the resources to go out and physically walk the whole border. He was dependent on maps of the time, particularly parish maps, and they had a number of inaccuracies because there just hadn't been the resources and people on the ground to survey it accurately. And if you look at the parish of Urayara map, you'll see Coree Creek flowing from the very summit of Mount Coree, in which case, yes, the straight line would have incorporated it, but the creek doesn't come from there at all. It starts to the northeast. So what happened was, in 1926, 11 years after the completion of the border survey, a surveyor by the name of Astley Pulver was sent in to just see what had been cut off, and the following year, 1927, the Commonwealth simply acquired that parcel of land so that catchment values could be maintained. They didn't change the border because that would require rewriting the legislation because the border is physically described in those 1909 acts. So they simply acquired that land, and I think that arrangement lasted probably until the 1990s when Brindabella National Park was declared by New South Wales in that area and catchment values hopefully would be maintained. So that's the answer to our Cotter catchment conundrum. So let's now go to the border survey. So it's June 1910, and Charles Scrivener sends young Percy Sheaf up to the top of Mount Coree. Now, Chief was the good-looking young chap next to Scrivener in that photograph on the right-hand end. Now, Chief is a Queenslander. How he felt about being sent up into the Brindabellas at the beginning of winter is anyone's guess. But Scrivener wasn't asking him to do something he himself would not have done, for Scrivener had surveyed in the snow back when they were looking at Dalgetty, you know, up the Snowy River there. So Chief heads up and begins the survey in June from Coree. And during the first few months, he makes this trip down to... don't know whose mobile that is, but it's not mine. I don't have one. He gets down to the Murrumbidgee within a couple of months. But the hardest part of his work was actually the very beginning, right up the top there of Coree, because there are quite substantial cliffs. And Sheaf's own description of the work here was, in places the country was so rough that the party carrying out the survey had to crawl on all fours, measure over precipices and descend in 1 mile about 1,500 feet. Because they had to measure distance physically. They didn't have electronic distance measures like we've had for a few decades. And they didn't have the old Gunter's chain, the 100-link chain. That was obsolete, but they still had these measuring wires or bands that they had to run across the landscape. So imagine doing that up there. However, he didn't even have the weather on his side because, as Scrivener reported, this work is proceeding under very unfavourable conditions since, though no great amount of rain has fallen, there are frequent showery days with occasional falls of snow. I'm sure that Percy Sheep might have wished he was back in Queensland at certain times, but I don't think he complained either, because this part of the job really stuck with him right through the rest of his life, and he was very proud of it. So he gets down to the Murrumbidgee, the lowest point on the border, and continues on. And he makes it through to One Tree Hill by February 1911. So that 30-kilometre section is completed. And his measurement of the distance there was later compared with a measurement from trigonometrical stations, and he was found to be accurate to within 0.8 of a centimetre for every 1.6 kilometres, or a third of an inch for every mile, which is an incredible level of accuracy. I think it works out to a difference of about 16 centimetres over 30 kilometres. Remarkable, and dedication. And so he starts to make his way along what is the northern catchment watershed of the Molonglo. And as he's going along there, he starts to meet trig stations, which had been built back in the 1870s by a chap called Edward H. Taylor and his piling party. They were called piling parties because they piled the stones together for the cairns that made the trigs. And, of course, that was part of the expansion of the trigonometrical network, all part of being able to survey land, to measure distance accurately across the landscape, especially in the wake of the free selection legislation, the increasing pressure on the survey department. And along that ridge, we still have the surviving cairn of one of those trigs, Guru Trig. The actual veins and mast have gone, but the cairn is still there. So that's 1870s, still there today, a significant heritage site in the territory. Just to the right on the horizon, you see that big rounded peak? Well, that's Coree. That's where Sheaf had started, and that's how far he'd got to by this stage. But as he's passing through this this lower country, of course, he's passing through existing portions of land. And he has to be very accurate because part of that land's going to be in New South Wales and part in the Territory. But as he goes, he finds that almost every portion boundary is inaccurate. And he described the situation in these terms. His work was greatly slowed down by, quote, the poor class of survey work effected by the New South Wales Lands Department years ago. And so what that meant was that he had to resurvey almost every portion that he went through. So it was quite a slow job and something that hadn't been anticipated before. Now, here's a picture of Percy and his team. He's on the right with a theodolite. This is actually taken in town. There's a famous photograph in the Parliamentary Triangle. There's a famous photo of King O'Malley driving a peg into the ground. Well, this is that scene just after the driving of the peg, I think, 1913 in the Parliamentary Triangle. So that gives an idea of what a survey party looked like at the time. And it also shows you that the border surveyors weren't out on the border all the time. They had a lot of work to do, though, into town, out, you know, back and forth. So there is Percy on the right with his team. And he makes his way around to the railway line. As I said, the railway, just this side of Queanbeyan, would be part of the border. And passing down through to Queanbeyan, of course, the most dramatic part of that landscape is the Molonglo Gorge, with this very distinctive mix of calitrus and eucalyptus vegetation, quite a steep valley, not exactly a gorge in world terms, but a steep valley. And as he was going along the railway, you can bet that the loco drivers who came by on the regular runs would have got used to seeing their survey party working along beside them. It would have been quite dramatic to see those steam locos going through and the steam and smoke coming up. Now, in 1913, Percy married. Earlier in his career, he'd worked out at Hilston in Western New South Wales. He got to know a young lady by the name of Katie McKellar, and they married in 1913, and Katie came to live with Percy in a tent. It's because they're living in tents on the border as they're going around, and that's how their early married life started. In amongst the tents of the labourers and the chainmen and the cook, not much privacy for a married couple. And on top of that, who should keep visiting but Percy's mother? And that's the woman on the left, Isabel. And this is a wonderful photo of the tent. Not very clear, but look at the gramophone. And there's a tablecloth, and I've seen other pictures of the camp. There's a silver cruet set, which is still in the family's possession. So they did have comforts out in the bush. The surveyors also had these flying camps, which were much rougher, but this is a base camp with Percy's mother, Isabel, and his wife, Katie. And there's also vegetation wound up the tent poles there. So is it Arbor Day or Wattle Day or Christmas? I'm not sure, but that's another interesting little decorative feature of this great photo. And so Sheaf starts to work further down the railway line. But look what's happening out in the west. A second survey party has got underway under Harry Mowat. Now, it was Scrivener's plan always to have only one party do the border so they could develop the expertise in that specific task and get it done. But the government was getting a bit antsy because of these delays, having to resurvey, et cetera, et cetera. They were putting pressure on Scrivener, so Scrivener appointed a second team under Harry Mowat, and we'll hear about Mowat's experiences and adventures shortly. So the border follows the railway for about 52 kilometres, right, from where Sheaf first got onto it down towards Williamsdale. And you'd think that surveying the border along the railway would be pretty straightforward. Well, no, it wasn't, because Sheaf found that there were discrepancies in the lands that had been acquired for the railway back in 1884. So he had to make repeated trips up to Sydney to talk with railways officials, the Surveyor General's Department, and land titles. And so this was another thing that he had to cope with and deal with within the context of the survey. Here's a page from one of the early annual reports of the Department of Lands and Surveys showing some of the equipment used, the Troughton and Sims theodolites in the top and the Bamberg theodolite in the bottom left-hand corner. I don't know specifically which instruments were used on the border, but this at least gives an indication of the types of theodolites that they had. And I've already talked about the measuring wires that they used. And there's a plane table there, bottom, second from the left on the bottom. So just an indication of the sort of equipment. It must have been pretty hardy sort of equipment too. I mean, a theodolite's a delicate instrument. If you're carrying them through the bush on a pack horse, you know, they'd have to pack them pretty well not to be wiped out on the side of a snow gum or something. And so the work goes on, and by mid-1914, Sheaf has left the railway, gone across the Murrumbidgee where it enters the territory, and he's up on watershed again, the divide between the Murrumbidgee and Nace Rivers. And that little section between the railway and that divide is interesting, where it crosses the Murrumbidgee, because the border actually follows the bank of the Bidgee for a little bit, but all the rest of that little section follows portion boundaries rather than cutting through them. And the point where the border crosses the river is at Angle Crossing. And, of course, Angle Crossing has been in the news lately because that is exactly where ACTU has built its new pipeline to take water from the Murrumbidgee through to Googong Dam. So here we have the border story where water is so central, and yet again, water is still with us in this time, especially after the last decade of drought where we all became so aware of the importance of water in the territory, of course. And so Sheaf starts to work down that range, known as the Clear Range, between the Murrumbidgee and the Nace River. And here's a chart of that very area. This is part of the FC18 series of charts. This series of charts was compiled as soon as the border survey had been done. There's about 13 of them that cover the whole territory based on the surveyor's field books. A very high standard of cartography. There's very nice topographic shading there. And you can see on the left the intersection of Nace Creek and the Gudgeonbee River. But the most important thing, of course, is the line of the border running down the centre here. And so it had been agreed that the agreed border between New South Wales and the Territory would be that as physically marked by the surveyors working under Scrivener's direction. And so they were putting marks in at each point. And on these watershed parts of the border, that meant wherever a range, the range they were following, wherever it changed direction, they would have to put in a mark. So wherever the bearing changed, so depending on the landform, it could be 50 metres between marks, or it could be a couple of hundred metres. And you can see those marks that are there, and they each had an alphanumeric reference number, all of them, and they are shown in the field books. And I think that the most common visitor to Sheaf as he was working would have been the local cockies, because here they are sort of losing half their land, you know, inside the territory. Well, they didn't actually lose it. A lot of people think that all the land in the territory was resumed immediately. Well, it wasn't. It was resumed as the government needed it. But nonetheless, it would be subjected to a different administration, different rates, et cetera, until it would be eventually resumed. And so you can imagine these farmers coming up to Sheaf and asking him, which part of my land am I going to lose to the federal sort of thing? And so the job is well underway by early 1915. Sheaf's getting down towards Mount Clear and Mowat's got past Mount Kelly. Now, this is Acton House, which stood right on this site, OK? So the old Acton property, this is Acton House. Now, Scrivener and his wife, they'd originally lived in tents on near the river, but by now they were living in Acton House. And this was a place of resort for the surveyors at the time because, as I said, the border surveyors were coming into town from time to time. And if they were here on a weekend, that was great because the Scriveners had tennis parties here at Acton House. And so it was a place where they could relax and socialise because there wasn't much else to do. I mean, there were the other homesteads, and in 1911, well, Duntroon had been established, and so there was some socialising out there. But the Scriveners were the centre of, I think, the early survey community. But in early 1915, Charles Scrivener retired, and Percy Sheaf was recalled back into Acton to take on higher duties as district surveyor. So he leaves our survey story at this point. And this is a picture of Percy Sheaf and Katie many years later, obviously, in their senior years at their house in Forest. Now, Sheaf remained on the survey staff till 1948 when he retired as the territory's chief surveyor. And the Canberra Times wrote at that time, "The job of which Mr. Sheaf is most proud is the survey of the territorial boundary." So it really stuck with him, especially those early experiences on Coree. And in fact, his daughter Jean, who is 94 years old, I was talking to her the other day, she still drives. I think she has the same gumption that her father had. She has told me how she would bring boyfriends home and Percy would grab them and regale them for hours about the border. And maybe that's why Jean never married. She never got a chance. But Percy surveyed well over half of the border, and he is remembered today in Sheaf Street in Holder, Sheaf House at the Canberra Boys Grammar School, and various survey points like Sheaf Trig on Isaac's Ridge. So that's Percy Sheaf, who made a major contribution to early Canberra. So he is replaced on the border by Frederick Marshall Johnston. Now, Freddie Johnston, obviously in later life shown here, but he was about 30 when he came onto the border in 1915, a West Australian. His father had been Surveyor General of Western Australia. He was a pretty stylish sort of guy. He'd worked on the Trans-Australia Railway Survey before coming to the Territory. And in 1915, he went on to the border. And he was to survey 20-odd kilometres of the border. He eventually, in his career, became the Commonwealth Surveyor General and first Director of National Mapping. So very high-level guy. And he's not commemorated in Canberra as far as I know, but there is a geodetic survey station in northern South Australia named after him. And the point where he takes over from Sheaf is just near Mount Clear. And I hope you're getting the impression that we really do have some magnificent country around us. I mean, you know, what we have here in the ACT is just fantastic, and that's an excellent example of that down around Mount Clear. And, of course, such rugged country, especially at that time, the surveyors used horses to get around, horse-drawn vehicles, where they could get them onto the range, pack horses, and moving on foot. But Freddie Johnston thought he could go one better, and he bought a Model T Ford. And there is a Model T Ford down in the Glorious Days exhibition. It's not Freddie's one, though. It's a luxury version. But Freddie wrote a very entertaining memoir called Knights and Theodolites, and he says in that how when he went to get his driver's licence at Queanbeyan in 1915, the policeman who rode with him had never been in a car before and was absolutely terrified. Have things changed in Queanbeyan, by the way? And we know it's true because there's the car. What a wonderful photograph. And that's at his survey camp on the southern border near Westerman's homestead. In handwriting on the back of that print at National Archives near Westerman's homestead. It looks like the Model T has got its own garage with that tent just behind it. But I'm also interested by the tent next door with that flue coming out in the smoke. I'd say that's the cook's tent most probably. Yeah. And Freddie Johnson had all sorts of interesting interactions with the locals down that way. I mean, he wrote about one of the grazier's wives who'd come along smoking a clay pipe. And she would sit in the car and repeatedly toot the horn because it was such a novelty. I'd love to know who that was. But one of the graziers themselves came up to him one day and started quizzing Freddie suspiciously, "Why aren't you married, lad?" You know, unmarried at that age. And so Freddie said evasively, "Oh, girls are too particular." And with that, the grazier looked him in the eye and said, "Well, you want to come round my way, mate? My gals ain't too particular." And Freddie wrote in his memoir, "I did not call..." And the word not is italicised. I just love that. But Freddie, the following year, joined the first AIF, because in 1916, First World War, joined the Survey Corps, went off to England and married a woman from Chelsea, and they had a couple of kids back in Australia. And so the job is completed in autumn 1915 with Johnston moving northwest from Wrights Hill and Mowat heading southeast from Sentry Box. They join up, and this five-year job, a national survey project in its way, along with the other state border surveys, is completed. And here's a scene at Johnson's camp. So that's Harry Mowat on the left, then Freddie Johnson, field assistants Reg Kelly and Kenneth Stretch. And the woman in the foreground is Iris Mowat, Harry Mowat's wife, who accompanied him for part of the survey and also stayed out at rural homesteads while Harry was up on the ranges. And again, we know from Freddie's memoir that they had a special celebratory dessert that night. Johnston's cook, a chap named Sid, instead of making spotted dog, which I think was like a plum pudding or something like that maybe, he got oranges and cut them in half, hollowed them out and filled them with jelly. And that was how they celebrated the completion of this major task. If they wanted to imbibe a drop or two, well, they couldn't have because King O'Malley had introduced prohibition 4 years earlier. But seeing as they were on the border, all they had to do was take a step sideways and they were in New South Wales. And maybe the surveyors wouldn't have indulged, but I'm sure those labourers would have hightailed it to the pub at Old Adam Enemy and brought back a bottle of rum or two. But on a more serious note, I think it is true to say that the survey of the ACT border is a far less contentious survey than some of the other state border surveys in Australia's history, and we can go into that in further detail perhaps during the questions. So we've heard about Sheaffe and Johnston. What about Harry Mowat? So Harry was New Zealand-born. He married Iris about a year before coming onto the border. He was aged 33 in 1913 when he started. He's remembered today in Mowat Street, Lynham. I'm sure everyone's familiar with Mowat Street, Lynham, a short street but a major one. He surveyed just over 90 kilometres, about 92 kilometres of the border, and he was known amongst his colleagues as Happy Harry because he so rarely smiled. But a good leader of men. He too had a notable survey career, but died under rather tragic circumstances in Sydney in the 1950s. So Harry sets out from the same point as Sheaffe had done, Mount Coree, but he's heading south, not northeast. And he was heading into the wilds of the Brindabellas and the Upper Cotter, and that area was described by Australia's acting Commonwealth geologist Griffith Taylor in these words: "The upper valley of the Cotter is so rugged and far from all settlement that only one or two people have traversed it, and the map simply indicates it by a broken line in a perfectly blank strip of territory!" Now, that's a slight overstatement. I mean, Indigenous Australians have been traversing it for 20-odd thousand years, and there were settlers in the Cotter, but not many. So the gist of what he's saying is true. Especially officially, what Harry's heading into is terra incognita. So he sets off October 1913. And I don't know how clear that is on the screen, but it's the Parish of Cotter map 1912. And there are very few known survey points. So there's the Bimbury Tree. Couple of surveyed blocks in the valley, but all along the ridge lines, including the border, it says approximate position of range, approximate position of range. They just didn't know because there's been too little surveying on the ground. And this funny little corner down the bottom here, which sticks out towards Mount Morgan, that's shown on early maps of the ACT, but it doesn't actually exist because the range doesn't run that way. It runs more southeasterly, as Mowat discovered when he was there on foot. So southeasterly from Bimbury and Murray through to Mount Scabby. So that's one way in which the Border Survey corrected the earlier impressions of the country. And as he's going, what do I say about magnificent country? I mean, you know, this is in our backyard, for goodness sake. Are we not fortunate to have this? It's wonderful. And that's why I go bushwalking and want to tell these stories, to bring them to people. It doesn't matter whether you go there yourself or not. It's just great to know that it's there. So this is on Mount Aggie and a photo of my late friend Bert Bennett. And the point here, the interesting point here, is that as Mowat went along, he was picking up local names for these places and putting them on the map. So Mount Aggie, named after Agnes Franklin of the Brindabella Franklin family. So this is about Christmas Eve 1913. Just after Christmas and into 1914, he gets onto the top of Mount Franklin. Here's a wonderful photo of Franklin family members on the trig. And, of course, they're all related to Miles Franklin. You know, she's in a neighbouring homestead down at Brindabella. That's Thomas Franklin in the foreground. And halfway up the cairn on the left, in that brilliant long dress and riding crop, that's Aggie, that's Agnes, OK? How she got up the cairn in that long dress, I don't know, but it's a wonderful shot. And it was a real habit of people to write their signatures on trig veins, and that's what the chap at the top is doing. So those early trig veins were wonderful historical sources, you know, where they still exist. And about a month later, Mowat is on top of Mount Janini. This is one of my winter photos. Of course, he's there in summer. But you can see Mount Coree, his starting point, way off in the background back there, Devil's Peak and Mount Coree. So you can see how far he has come. And that strip down neighbouring Mount Franklin, that's actually a ski run that was cut by the Canberra Alpine Club in the 30s, 40s period. And this is a view across to Mount Ginger on the Brindabellas from Tibbinbilly. You can see the ruggedness of the country, and also it's heavily timbered. One of the major jobs of the labourers in these survey parties was to clear lines of sight for the surveyor's theodolite. Now, there were about six people in each survey team. There was the surveyor, a field assistant, a chainman, a couple of labourers and a cook. And it's really interesting realising how stratified these parties were. Now, in terms of salary, Scrivener earned about $900 a year, Chief $450, Mowat and Johnson about $330, a chainman half that much, and a cook still less. Now, obviously, you're going to have that gradation payment in any organisation, but this stratification is seen elsewhere. In pictures of them, the surveyors are always in coat and tie in the field. The labourers are in labouring clothes, as we saw earlier. And in terms of address, whenever Scrivener wrote to his surveyors, he would say, Mr. Surveyor Sheaf, Mr. Surveyor Johnson, Mowat. But if it was the labourers, he'd just say Smith or Jones, you know. So very interesting sort of social side coming out there. And here's a page from one of Mowat's field books, Rolling Ground Gap, just south of Gingera. And this is to give you an idea of all the interest that's in these books. So we see the borderline along here. We see the sorts of marks being described. So timber post, the reference tree out here, and the sort of marks they're putting on them. The Commonwealth Survey mark, which is a state arrow with a bar under it, and all the bearings and distances. He shows his camp, okay, April 1914. And the historical features, like bridle tracks and where they come from and to, a reference to water down this creek, you know, so for someone coming along up and knows where water is, and the track going off to Coolum. And so all sorts of interest in these as historical documents. But shortly after May 1914, Mowat gets snowed in on the range and he can't continue the survey. So somehow he gets a message to Scrivener back in Acton, "Can I come home, sir?" And Scrivener says, "Well, no. You can come down from the range, but I want you to stay out there and survey the upper Cotter, because although work on the Cotter Dam's begun, we're still looking for a gravitational dam site where water could be brought down by gravity." So Mowat spends the frosty winter of 1914 tramping the upper Cotter. He would have known this place, the old fields, old hut up in there, which is long gone, wonderful slab and shingle building. And even today, there's a place that's remembered by locals as Mowat's camp in the valley. And one of the dam sites that Mowat did find is surprisingly close to where Corran Dam was built in the 1960s. But with the retreat of the snow and the coming of the next summer, he's up on Mount Bimbury, our highest peak. This is a photo of J.H.L. Cumston and his boys doing a bushwalk there in 1931. Cumston was the head of the Department of Health, had a very strong interest in the Cotter as our water source, did lots of walks, and that's the original 1870s trig that they're putting their names on, no doubt. And so Mowat passed here in early 1915. So that's the view today, or at least before the bushfires, from the top of Bimbury, with Corran in the distance. And it's the Brindabella Range running along on the left. Now, you'd think that surveying along a range would be pretty easy, you know, pretty straightforward, but the Brindabellas are a very rounded range. It would be very easy to get sidetracked and go down one of those subsidiary spurs and having to come back. So I'm sure that Mowat would have been reconnoitring ahead all of the time, and I'm sure that local knowledge would have been important to him, in the same way he picked up these local names. He had local bushmen with him. We know that one of the Lutons from Shannon's Flat was one of his labourers, and they would have been helping him, you know, find his way along the range to make sure he didn't go down the wrong spur. One name that he didn't pick up is Mount Scabby, way down the southern end, right at the source of the Cotter, actually, and that name didn't come onto maps until the 1920s, so for some reason that was bypassed nomenclature-wise. And the next big peak he got to was Mount Kelly. Now, there's that triangular bite in the southern part of the border where the border suddenly runs northward again and then south, so that's Mount Kelly. And the interesting point here is how it got its name. So you can see the top of the peak up here, and how he's written "named by me, Mount Kelly," in inverted commas. Now, he never else wrote "named by me," because when he was incorporating local names, he just put it in. But the story behind this is that his field assistant was Reg Kelly, and I was able to contact Kelly's surviving daughter, who's a Catholic nun, Sister Kate Kelly, and she told me the story that her father had actually collapsed on the mountain with Mowat, and Mowat thought he was going to die, and he named the peak after him. Fortunately, he did survive. But, and so does the name, and hence the reference to Kelly. And again, you can see the descriptions of the gumba, the timber, and the rocks, etc., and the sorts of marks that are being put in. But this is also of interest. Mileposts omitted May 1915 due to snow. So that's 2 years in a row when there were substantial May snowfalls. Now, we don't get substantial May snowfalls these days. You know, you'll have the odd fall in April or May where the resorts say, oh, it's going to be a great season, but they're actually fairly light. And for snow to be this heavy, to stop these guys working, for the environmental historians here, surveyors' field books can be a really interesting source. And so the border ridge runs southeast from Kelly. Here's a view there during our field work in 96. And some of the places here where Mowat put marks are in very difficult places. One's on a very high bowl that you have to clamber up, another one you have to jump across a chasm. And it makes you wonder whether there were thoughts of mutiny amongst the team. But the fact that that didn't occur, I guess, indicates that Mowat was a good leader of men. And the next major peak, and really the last major peak on that part of the border, is Sentry Box Mountain, a wonderful place named after that huge boulder in the distance, Sentry Box Rock. And this is a name which was known of officially for a long time. It's shown certainly on the 1871 County of Cowley map. And there I am with one of Mowat's marks, the line of stones, the lock spit, and the actual mark is in the centre. And you can see my trusty compass, and the importance of that compass will be revealed shortly. Sentry Box is a pretty timeless sort of place. Yes, bushfires come and go. Luckily, the 03 fire didn't burn very severely there. About the only significant change has been the colour of my hair, which is rather significant. Too much time out in the snow. That's my excuse. So this is at the end of Sentry Box, and that cliff in the foreground, Mowat described that in his field book as a precipitous sidling. Isn't that a wonderful term, precipitous sidling? These guys were cultured. You know, he didn't just write bloody cliff, you know. Precipitous sidling. But they would have been relieved to find that the border ridge actually, it doesn't go down there. They didn't have to go straight down that precipitous sidling. It goes around to the right and then runs out along the Bobian Divide, which is this timbered ridge here. So that's the border. New South Wales over here, ACT here. And the point where Mowat and Johnston met, somewhere around in here. I've actually, you know, found that last mark that Mowat put in and thought about how he would have felt at that point. So in the final section of the talk, let's briefly look at the field work that I did. I walked half the border. I didn't do all of it because with heritage grants there's a strong onus on you to do things out of your own pocket in kind contribution, and it wasn't possible to do the whole thing, so I did half. And I did about half of that with friends and colleagues and the other half on my own. And the methodology, well, GPS then wasn't like GPS now. ACT survey staff came out for a day with GPS. It wasn't all that helpful. I did have a limited amount of funding to employ a surveyor, and a friend of mine, John Stevens, joined me. I was his chainman, theodolite, electronic distance measure, a ranging pole. We did 3 or 4 days, very accurate but very slow and obviously too expensive. So the bulk of the work I knew would have to be done with compass and pacing. So I went through all the field books, converted their bearings to magnetic so that I could use a compass, converted their imperial measurements from links to metres so I could pace it. So what were some of the marks that were found? Well, here's a lovely example of one of Mowat's 8-inch squared timber posts with CT. What would CT stand for? Okay, yes, we think Capital Territory, but actually Commonwealth Territory. But certainly CT. Sadly, this mark was destroyed in the 03 bushfires, but there are other examples on the border. 3-inch downpipe filled with concrete. This is just south of Franklin on the peak I call the skiers Little Janini. You wouldn't think that's 100 years old, but it is. 1-inch pipe filled with concrete down near Mount Kelly, and you can see the very substantial lock spit or rock spit, the line of stones, reflecting the change of bearing. And you can stand over that with your compass, and they're very accurately placed. A concrete cylinder. Now, these are referred to simply as that concrete cylinder. So there's no mention of the rusty tin can that Mowat obviously used as the formwork, okay? And I guess they were empty food tins from their kit, and that's how they were put in. Railway spike, again with stones from a lock spit around it, and a nail set into concrete. Now, surveyors make carvings in trees nearby called reference trees. They refer to the mark, okay, so the later surveyor coming along can see where it is. And this is a lovely example, northwest of Sentry Box, with the Commonwealth Survey arrow, the arrow and bar, and then the CT. And on the right is John Stevens, my surveying friend. And on the left, Ian McLeod. I don't know whether Ian's here today, but he spent a lot of time with me in the field and made a great contribution to the project. As did Russell Wenholtz, actually, an ACT, now retired surveyor, and others. This is a wonderful tree on Bimbury. This one faces the weather. It faces the southwest, so a century of blizzards. It's worked at it, but you can still see the arrow and the CT. But it's a work of nature as much as a work of man. One of Mowat's mile trees, so the M18, you know, lovely carving. They had a stencil in their kit and pencils and a mallet and chisel, and that's how they did these. Sadly, this tree, which was an excellent one, really close to the Franklin Road, easy to take people to, it was destroyed in the fires. Mowat's 50-mile cairn down near Yark Gap. Sheaf's 94-mile tree, of course, he's going in another direction, so his measurement of miles is different to Mowat's. It's a lovely blaze. It's huge. It's over a metre high, and it's still there, I understand, because the fires didn't get over there. And Johnston's 112-mile tree, and I've taken lots of bushwalkers here, including staff from the museum. A great example, but sadly last year it collapsed, so it has now gone. And one of Johnston's ordinary reference trees, each of the marks had an alphanumeric number, as I said, and in Johnston's case, he actually included that in the carving, so that's E42. So he went that step further, you know. And sadly, this tree collapsed about a year after I found it. So all of these reference trees will be gone in time. I mean, trees die, they burn, they rot. And there is a case to be made for taking one of these trees, acquiring it by the National Museum or Canberra Museum and Gallery so they can be conserved in the future. So this is shows the chameleon-like quality of some of these marks. There's actually two marks here, one of them possibly dating from the 1880s because of earlier surveys that had been done on the pre-border area because it was then, you know, a boundary between parishes, etc. So some of the impacts on marks, human interference is one. Now, this is a mark down near Scabby. You can see the lock spit, and the concrete cylinder has been taken out and put next to it by someone. And I have read in bushwalkers' reports where people have written, we found an Aboriginal stone arrangement, but there was a rusty can in it, so we threw the can away. And that is really sad because it misunderstands what an Aboriginal stone arrangement is on the one hand and what these survey marks are on the other. The bulldozing of the Brindabella's firebreak in the 1950s, you know, wiped out huge numbers of marks. Of course, you'd understand the reasons for doing it. That was a bad fire time. But nonetheless, that break from the base of Coree through to Franklin, you know, it really did take out a lot of marks. And then, of course, January 2003, this is a view from Mount Ainslie at about 2:15 on that terrible day, the 18th of January, large numbers of the timber marks and reference trees were destroyed. Since that time, the ACT Survey Office has commissioned survey parties to go out and reinstate marks that were lost both during the fire and the bulldozing of the firebreak. So that's great they're there because these marks do legally define the border on the ground. But, of course, those new marks don't have the heritage significance of the old ones, which have that direct significance with the survey. So this brings me to the end of the presentation. Thank you for listening. I hope that this has been a meaningful experience for you. I hope it's led to your interest in the border and has explained why we are what we are, the shape and who the people were. And I hope you've enjoyed our virtual tour around the border through some magnificent country. So thanks very much. So I'm happy to take a few questions if you wish. And we are recording, so if you don't mind waiting for the mic. Rick.
Okay, all right. Rick Hinges, you know, yeah. Matt. Matt, following the surveyors came the engineers, as you know. My dad was one of those back in the 30s. Worked on the old Cotter Dam and, in fact, all the dams. Yeah. And I was wondering whether you might at some stage do a book on some of these old engineers and particularly the dam workers. Yeah. I've come across a number of them. They're now getting into their 90s. So we're running out of time on that issue.
Yes, thank you. My book, Rugged Beyond Imagination, has a section on the dams. Obviously, it doesn't mention your father or you know, large numbers of names, but it does represent a summary history of those dams in the Cotter Valley. I did do an oral history and archival project called Dams of the Cotter back in the 90s, which is held in various libraries. There is the engineering institution's history. And I know that Keith Baker is working on a new volume on engineering in the ACT as a centennial project. I could put you in contact with Keith, actually, because I think that would be a good idea. So if you want to see me at the end, and I can get your email address if you'd like to do that. Yep. Sorry, we're just up the back there.
Thank you very much for a very interesting presentation. I noted that you used a lot of pictures from, obviously, when you've been out doing bushwalking, and I was just wondering... This presentation has inspired me to want to go out and do some bushwalking in the area I haven't
Good.
As yet done.
Good.
And I was just wondering if you could perhaps suggest what group or who's best to make contact with in order to experience some of the bushwalking that would take me out to some of those points.
Yeah. Well, the National Parks Association, which is really the community group that campaign for Namajee National Park, they have regular walks every week. There's also the Canberra Bushwalkers Club. And there's a member of the Canberra Bushwalkers by the name of John Evans who has really gone border marker crazy. He's a fantastic guy. And soon he will have covered the whole border and photographed every surviving mark. So if you contact either of those two organisations, there are occasional ranger guided walks as well. I mean, I used to lead quite a lot of walks for groups, including the National Trust. I tend to not do that so much these days. But those sorts of groups, yeah, there's plenty of opportunity. And down here, I think, the chap in the blue.
Thank you for an interesting presentation. In your introduction, you started mentioning the history of Dalgetty and then moving on to the Yass Canberra district.
Yes.
I understand that Scrivener was very, very loath to have Yass Canberra as a federal territory because of the risk of water pollution down in the Mildura area. Are you able to elaborate on that?
What I can say about that is that, I mean, as far as pollution coming into the territory, I mean, it was because it could be confined, if you like, pollution into the territory wasn't so much of a problem. I don't know what he felt about things downstream, but he did. He was a bit dubious about the Cotter having enough water. And I think he particularly wanted the Queanbeyan system in it because of that. Now, there is going to be a presentation about Scrivener on Tuesday at the National Conference of the Surveying and Spatial Sciences Institute, where I'm repeating this talk. There's a heritage and history workshop on that Tuesday, next Tuesday, and one of the other presenters will be talking about Scrivener. So if you contact that organisation, that event is at the National Convention Centre. So that's the best reference I can give you.
1913 was the year that Canberra was declared as the capital.
It was named. It was named that year. But the territory came into being in 1911.
And yet they started survey in 1910.
Yes. You had to pass the legislation. So those acts were passed in 1909 And it was written into the Acts that they would become active as of the 1st of January 1911. So, yes, work was going on before you could say the territory became an entity.
So there was still the debate with the Dalgety site.
No, I think that was put to bed once Carruthers said that he wouldn't hand over the land. That's why they went back to the drawing board. And once they decided on Yass Canberra, then they were committed to Yass Canberra, especially once Wade had agreed to the shape that we talked about earlier.
Thank you.
Yep.
Way back in the 70s, I was involved with the surveys of the Trigg surveys here in Canberra, and we had to put beacons on top of Mount Bimbury and on Mount Clear. And as a matter of comparison, we used helicopters to put those two beacons on, not like poor old Mowat and Chafe, who had to walk up them. And that was quite a logistical problem at the time. And also, in the 70s, I was the president of the local institution at the time, and we had a lot of Scrivener's old gear, which I presented to the National Library. And I also visited Scrivener's house down in Mount Irvine.
Yes.
And his house was a hexagonal, I think. And they told me that he had a room in the middle, and on all the walls he had lift-up frames, so he'd pass things out and people would pass them into him. So he's a very organised man.
Thank you for that comment. Well, can you just wait for the mic, if you don't mind? Just wait for the mic.
That material from Scrivener was also held by the Mount Wilson Historical Society for many years, and they mounted quite an impressive static display, which is now owned, I believe, by Bathurst.
Okay.
However, part of my interest in Scrivener comes from association with Mount Irvine, but it was also most impressive to note that Scrivener, as well as the tasks he performed with his team here in Canberra, made extremely comprehensive and authoritative surveys of the entire Ryde and, I believe, Parramatta and or Willoughby Shires, or municipalities in Sydney, as part of his professional contribution. Amazing man.
Yes, well, he was a New South Wales surveyor of considerable experience, so he had moved across the state, and that's why he was chosen, and a very good choice, I might say. And, yes, he did retire to the Blue Mountains and Mount Wilson, Mount Irvine. Yeah. So, shall we leave it there? And don't forget, exit via the bookshop. Thank you very much for coming today.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.